Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Tallahassee Regional Airport. Offering service through Silver Airways with daily service from Tallahassee to Tampa and Orlando with connections to the Bahamas. Fares and information available online at silverairways.com. Lisa Miller and Associates, offering strategies to solve legislative, regulatory, and business development challenges. Every challenge offers new opportunities for individually tailored client solutions. Online at lisamillerassociates.com. And from the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, committed to Florida's $71.8 billion hospitality and tourism industry, whose members provide over 1 million Florida jobs. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. More at FRLA.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
The Florida Supreme Court hears a case asserting juveniles sentenced to life without parole deserve new hearings.
Should we not consider, if you don't like my word, children, should we not factor in that we are dealing with the juveniles of Florida?
Also tonight, as a series of gun-related measures get ready for floor votes, some question the need for some of them.
We ought to be dealing with issues that really make sense, those who are uninsured. We ought to be dealing with education. We shouldn't be dealing with laws that already exist just to supercharge them for no reason.
We'll also talk about required state tests for some private school students, along with genetically modified foods, and how tough it can be to create a new state government agency. I'm Tom Flanagan. On day three of the 2014 Florida lawmaking session, this is Capitol Report. More than 200 Floridians serving life in prison for crimes they committed as minors could get new sentencing hearings, depending on how the state Supreme Court rules on a case it heard today. As Jessica Palumbo reports, the court must decide whether a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision applies retroactively to previously sentenced juveniles.
Rebecca Falcon was 15 when, according to court records, she shot a Panama City cab driver in the head during an attempted robbery. Records also show Falcon had been sexually abused, she was depressed, she'd never committed a crime before, and she participated in the robbery impulsively at the urging of older boys she was hoping to impress. But because Florida law requires life sentences for juveniles convicted of first-degree murder, Falcon's judge and jury were not allowed to consider any factors that might have justified a lesser sentence than the one she got, life without parole. During oral arguments in Falcon's case, Florida Supreme Court Justice Barbara Pariente said the girl's situation is hardly unique.
Children for the last 20 years who, no matter what the circumstances, whether somebody's girlfriend or boyfriend, they get, and the trial judge says, I don't want to have to give this sentence, but I have no choice, which is, they get life without the possibility of parole at the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars to the state of Florida.
15 years passed after Falcon was sent to prison. Then in a 2012 case called Miller v. Alabama, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled juveniles are entitled to individual sentencing that takes all factors into consideration. In other words, mandatory life sentences are unconstitutional. A bill moving in the legislature aims to bring Florida's juvenile sentencing rules in line with that decision. But Justice Peggy Quince asked, what about the hundreds of juveniles who've already been sentenced to life without any mitigating factors considered?
So we just turn our backs on the fact that there are 200 and some, even if you say 500 of them, young people who are sitting in jail forever.
But Tricia Meggs Pate, an attorney for the state, argued the Miller decision does not apply to old cases, adding it might be difficult to resentence offenders anyway.
You're going to have witnesses. We're going to have facts about the crime scene, how the crime occurred, what happened, medical examiners. And some of these cases are 20 years old that were final for they've been final for a long time.
Justice Fred Lewis cut her off.
Having to muster up witnesses, people have retired.
Could I ask a question as you're going through this litany of horribles? Should the fact that we're dealing with our children be factored into that equation in some way?
Well, I think we're dealing with juvenile murderers and only juvenile murderers.
I understand. But I mean, they are considered juveniles.
Several of the court's seven justices asked whether, if they do rule Miller applies to old cases, resentencing hearings would be necessary or the chance for parole would suffice. Pate says the state believes resentencing would be necessary, and she asked the justices to at least provide trial courts some guidelines on how to proceed. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Also today, the Florida Supreme Court ruled that undocumented immigrants are not eligible for admission to the Florida bar. The unanimous decision stemmed from the case of Jose Godinez Semperio, who came to the United States at age 9 from Mexico and later graduated from law school at Florida State University. Florida Public Radio's Jessica Palumbo will have the full story on tomorrow's Capitol Report. Several gun-related measures are now heading for floor votes, including a House bill aimed at revising Florida schools' zero-tolerance policies. As Sasha Cordner reports, both chambers are also expected to take up a measure that seeks to protect gun owners from insurance discrimination.
Unlike its Senate companion, there hasn't been a single no vote against the House bill seeking to relax Florida's zero-tolerance policies. Ocala Republican Representative Dennis Baxley says he wants to make sure kids aren't facing suspension or a juvenile record for an act as simple as wearing a T-shirt with a gun on it.
I think it does lay down the proper balance and hopefully will be an example and an opportunity for administrators to feel they are empowered to make those common sense judgments.
Palm Harbor Democratic Representative Carl Zimmerman says he supports the so-called Pop-Tart bill, named after the actions of a young Maryland boy who was suspended for chewing his breakfast into a gun shape.
What I really like about this bill is it still allows for disciplinary action if it is a threat. If a kid comes to a teacher and points their finger and goes, pew, like that, as a threat, they can still be disciplined. This just takes the absurdity out of that.
South Pasadena Republican Representative Kathleen Peters says she, too, likes the bill, but she says it could go further. She wants to expand it to include more circumstances where students won't face arrest.
It is unfortunately common practice for our kids to be criminalized for things like writing on the bathroom wall or cursing at a teacher or things like that. And we are wrapping up our kids in the juvenile justice system for unnecessary and unreasonable reasons.
And the 16 members of the House Education Committee approved the bill, but in another House panel, debate grew contentious as lawmakers vetted another bill seeking to enhance penalties against insurers who discriminate against gun owners. Fort Walton Beach Republican Representative Matt Gates says he's only seeking to protect gun owners from discrimination by allowing them to have the added protection of bringing their grievance to court. But after repeated requests from lawmakers on the panel, he could only provide a few instances where his bill would have applied.
I can tell you that Castle Key Insurance on January 15th canceled Mr. Richard Page's policy as a result of his ownership of ammunition, so I presume that that was information they acquired in some manner. But there was a circumstance recently where Citizens Insurance, through their clearinghouse on their website, had posed questions regarding gun ownership. However, as was pointed out in the last committee of reference for this bill, Citizens quickly removed those questions from their website.
While he voted to move the bill forward, Pensacola Republican Representative Mike Hill says he's got misgivings, mainly that he's not sure there's a problem.
And I am a proponent of the free market, of allowing consumers to choose and also businesses to choose how they want to operate. And it seems like this is creating a hindrance to that. Should it occur to where a insurance company cancels a policy because of the firearms or amount of ammunition there, the consumer has the ability to go to another company and choose who they want.
And Port St. Lucie Democratic Representative Larry Lee offered a terrifying example of the bill's potential to create unintended consequences.
Just fast forward, and sometime in the future, if this bill passes, I guarantee you this will happen. You have a condo, a townhouse, or an apartment owner that's storing up tons of ammunition. That building catches fire. You can have an explosion that will take out a whole wing.
And Coconut Creek Democratic Representative Jim Waldman called it a waste of time.
And it's only here because you want to be able to say we did something for gun owners this year, so we can go out there and talk about everybody's Second Amendment rights. That's ridiculous.
After taking more than half an hour to discuss the bill, the House Regulatory Affairs Committee agreed to pass it 11-5, with most Democrats opposed. Meanwhile, the Senate Appropriations Committee passed its version with bipartisan support in 4 minutes Thursday, with some Democrats voting against the measure. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Still to come on Capitol Report, more Florida students could go to private schools using state-funded scholarships next year, although that has some people concerned.
We're not talking about helping just disadvantaged people, economically disadvantaged people. The program is expanding to include people who have more means.
Does the state of Florida's need for better information technology justify the creation of a new state government agency?
In light of all the problems with DEO's Connect, and understanding in the next few years, we're going to have the FLAIR project coming up.
Should genetically modified food products sold in Florida have to carry a label informing consumers of the fact?
We made sure that our farms did it the way we wanted to. You know, they raised the plants or the animals in the proper way like Mother Nature did. I never had to ask, are your seeds GMO?
And we'll wrap up this evening's coverage by letting you sit in on an actual gaggle as Governor Rick Scott fields reporters' questions at the Capitol.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment.
More Florida students could get private school scholarships next year under a planned expansion of the state's corporate tax scholarship program. But as Lynn Hatter reports, those students may also be subjected to state-mandated exams.
Florida lawmakers are eyeing the state's biggest source of revenue to boost private school scholarships for low-income students. The House plan would create the sales tax scholarship program and allow businesses to steer sales tax dollars to fund more scholarships.
Well, I certainly think it's a great bill, and I'm so glad the speaker's behind it and the Senate president's behind it.
John East is the vice president for policy of Step Up for Students, the group administering the corporate tax scholarship program. The program still has about 25,000 students on a waiting list even after more than 60,000 scholarships were paid out this year. Right now, money put into the scholarship program is capped at about $286 million, but that cap increases every year. And under the proposed expansion, the program could grow over the next 5 years to spend $874 million annually. That's enough for roughly 150,000 scholarships, and more than enough to cover both the students currently enrolled in the program and those on the waiting list. But East says the potential size of the cap can be misleading.
But if students don't choose the scholarship, the law requires, very appropriately, that the money be returned to the state treasury.
For the first time ever, the scholarship program would be open to students who are not eligible for free and reduced lunch. A family of four earning up to about $60,000 a year would become eligible. Partial scholarships based on a sliding scale would be available for higher-income families, but low-income kids would still get first priority. At first blush, the plan sounds good to schools that teach those students. Jason Flom is Learning and Communications Director at Tallahassee's Cornerstone Learning Community School.
We are a private school with a public mission, and being able to reach out and provide the type of educational setting that we have to a broader range of students who might not otherwise have access to our program means that we're better able to fulfill our mission.
But even though he works for a private school, which, full disclosure, underwrites with Florida Public Radio, Flom worries there's not the same passion for public education, and he worries the voucher expansion may go too far.
You know, what if some of this money were going towards cultivating innovative programs in the public sector of schools, because we do have great schools and there is obviously a demand for an alternative approach to education.
The 15% of students at Cornerstone who use the corporate tax scholarship take a nationally normed test, such as the Iowa Test of Basic Skills. However, that test, unlike the ones kids in public schools take, don't determine whether children are promoted. While Flom says he believes the expansion is a good thing, he's concerned about a potential hiccup the bill may soon encounter, making scholarship students take the same tests as public school kids.
Depending on what the expectations are for what students are expected to do, it could increase the hurdle for you know, the number of schools that would accept it.
Senate President Don Gates has said he'd like to see children in the corporate tax scholarship program take the same state assessments as public school kids as a way to ensure an apples-to-apples comparison. That argument is once again being raised by lawmakers like Coral Springs Democratic Representative Jared Moskowitz.
So our public school students have to take the FCAT, correct?
You recognize.
As of right now, yes.
Follow, Mr.
Follow up.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the students in these schools do not have to take the FCAT. They can take an alternative test.
You recognize.
That is correct.
You recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Why the difference?
If the expansion goes through, the state expects to lose more than $120 million in sales tax revenue over that same five-year time frame. But it also believes those losses are negated by savings generated by students switching from public schools to private ones. House Speaker Will Weatherford has promised what he calls a massive expansion of the program. But the size and scope of that expansion has even lawmakers who support the corporate tax scholarship program saying they're uncomfortable with the House plan now on the table. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Florida lawmakers are hoping the creation of a new state information technology agency might save taxpayers money. But as Ryan Bank tells us, despite a unanimous vote of support, not everyone is certain those savings will happen, and some are now questioning the bill's chances of becoming law.
Margate Democratic Senator Jeremy Ring gave the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on General Government a deluge of reasons for consolidating the state's technology within a single, standalone agency. Ring mentioned how Florida is the only state without a chief information officer.
As you know, because we've discussed this quite a bit, our state ranks last or close to last in virtually every measurement related to IT.
Ring also warned the state's cybersecurity could be at risk. In the past, he cited the recent security breach at big box retailer Target as a prime example of what could happen without a sufficiently robust technology plan. And a state with a $75 billion budget has a lot to lose. But some committee members, including Kissimmee Democratic Senator Darren Soto, wondered how much the state currently spends on technology and whether Florida had anything to gain from the creation of a new agency.
I noticed in the fiscal impact, I would have assumed that this would save money ultimately, but it's kind of gray on that area. Would you want to touch on that subject a little bit?
Yeah.
Ring admitted the answer is a bit of a catch-22. The state will only know how much it's saving if it spends the money needed to create the agency. Ring's bill would appropriate close to $5 million for the agency's inaugural year and $3 million every year thereafter. That money would go to salaries for an additional 25 employees who'll be moving from the governor's office to the Department of Management Services. But the bill's future is far from certain. In fact, the Senate has passed similar bills numerous times, only to be thwarted by the more conservative House or the governor's veto pen. The latter pitfall Ring joked about when addressing the committee's chair, Umatilla Republican Senator Alan Hayes.
This has been your bill every year, and I don't think you know it either. But somehow you end up feeling it keeps getting vetoed, so we're going to try a little differently this year.
Your dad tell you you should keep quiet sometime?
The bill Hayes supported in 2012 did make it through both houses, but was vetoed by Governor Rick Scott, effectively defunding the state's first iteration of a tech agency, even though that department still exists in statute. But this year seems different. After months of trouble with the state's $63 million unemployment benefit website, Connect, and with more expensive tech projects on the horizon, Ring argues the state can't afford to wait.
This is critical in light of all the problems with DEO's Connect and understanding in the next few years we're going to have the FLARE project coming up as well as a new human resources project coming up, which are big $100 million item tickets.
It's big projects like Connect and FLARE, the state's accounting system, that have many officials changing their tune when it comes to supporting the creation of a new state agency. The proposed Agency for State Technology, or AST, would be in charge of administering any tech project costing more than $50 million. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Bank.
Genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, are a cause for concern for some people, including some members of the Florida legislature. Although there are no proposed bans for GMOs in Florida, there's still legislation that GMO supporters say is not needed. We get more on that story from Alicia Mandigo with member station WMFE in Orlando.
The science behind this is solid.
University of Florida Horticultural Sciences Department Chair Kevin Folta is a surprisingly outspoken advocate for GMOs. He says science has not only proven that GMOs are safe, but that they can save lives. Golden rice, for instance, is a genetically engineered rice that's a source of beta-carotene, a vital nutrient that's absent from the diets of impoverished populations in India and Africa. Folta says the fight against GMOs is keeping golden rice from getting to the people who need it.
Economists and people who study epidemiology have examined what were the costs of not deploying this technology, and they're talking about in India alone, 1.4 million human life years lost.
Florida House Bill 1 and companion Senate Bill 558 aren't about banning GMOs. They would require that foods produced or grown with GMOs be labeled. But for farmers like DeLeon Springs dairy man Gerald Fieser, GMO labeling could increase feed and production costs. He says he was initially suspicious of GMOs, but now he thinks they're a good thing.
I think they have helped to reduce the carbon footprint. I think they've been able to help us reduce insecticides and herbicides in the production of food. You know, we've reached a system in the world today where we don't need 50% of the people or more growing food for the other 50%.
Not all farmers agree.
Okay.
Paul Thomason is a fourth-generation produce farmer in Sam Sula in Volusia County. He doesn't buy the argument that farmers have been engineering our food since the beginning of time.
I don't believe that's accurate. I believe that maybe hybrids have been in place for thousands of years, not GMOs.
Thomason frequently conducts farm tours for chefs, food and beverage managers, and other members of the food industry so they can get an up-close look at how the produce they're buying is grown. Trish Strom participated in this recent farm tour. She comes from a family of cattle ranchers and ran a cattle operation herself before becoming a wholesale retail food distributor. She says it's hard for people to understand that GMO labeling could make things really difficult for farmers. But at the same time, she says the public demand to know what's in our food is now undeniable.
Before, we didn't ask. We made sure that our farms did it the way we wanted to. You know, they raised the plants or the animals in the proper way like Mother Nature did. I never had to ask, are your seeds GMO? What kind of grass do you have? And over the last year, I've had to ask almost every farm because someone has called me and asked me that.
Thomason agrees that GMO labeling is likely to increase the cost of farming, and that's tough for an industry that doesn't have strong profit margins to begin with.
People need to know what they're getting and what they're eating, you know, so we're in 100% support of that, and we have been, you know, from the beginning.
Kevin Folta says GMO labeling is unnecessary and is being driven by disdain for a particular seed company and a suspicion of science.
If this is something that's artificial or something that's done in a laboratory, it must be evil. So there's a number of very strange layers that are not scientific that are backing this kind of thinking.
House and Senate GMO labeling bills failed to make it through committee last year. The U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates 70% of food products sold in supermarkets contain GMOs. I'm Alicia Mandigo in Orlando.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally, tonight, we'll let you sit in on an event that few outside the Capitol Press Corps get to experience close up. It's called a gaggle, which is what reporters call it when a group of them gather around a newsmaker, most typically a high government official, such as Florida Governor Rick Scott. Today, Governor Scott was part of a gaggle that took place right after the morning cabinet meeting. These events are usually noisy, occurring as they do in the hustle and bustle of the hallway outside the meeting room. More than a dozen reporters pressed in from every side with their cameras, microphones, and handheld recorders, vying for the governor's attention, and you may have to strain a bit to hear what some of the questions were. But the sound is unedited, so you can hear exactly what happens when the governor and the Capitol Press Corps interact.
Be glad to answer any questions anybody has.
Governor Scott?
Yes.
It's a different topic, but I want to ask you, are you writing a book?
I'm not planning on having a book before the election.
Are you working on a book for after the election?
I'm not planning on one before the election.
Governor, Representative Eagle has introduced legislation that would require drug testing at anyone running for office, and
I know you remember the little bit of incident that happened here with the Daily Show a couple years ago. What's your thoughts on that bill?
I haven't reviewed the bill, but look, I think everybody in our state ought to, you know, that's running for or in office ought to be held accountable.
Governor, you've signed off on a new security plan for the Capitol, and I wanted to get your thoughts on that. Basically, that security plan would ensure that what we had happen over the summer would not repeat itself. Could you explain why you signed off on the new security plan for the Capitol?
Well, the security plan was worked on through the Florida Department of Law Enforcement and Capitol Police. They're responsible for this. They went through the House and the Senate, and it was a proposal they made, and I signed off on it.
But why? Why did you sign off on it?
It's a proposal they made, and I signed off on it. They're responsible for the security of the Capitol.
Governor, the lawsuit against BP, I thought you really didn't like suing them.
But it's the right time to hold BP accountable for environmental harm to our state, and so that's why we joined in the lawsuit.
Governor, do you support the state taking over Lake Okeechobee discharges?
Say that again, please.
Do you support the state taking over Lake Okeechobee?
You know, here's what's disappointing. The federal government's responsible for the dike at Lake Okeechobee. They've not put the money up that they should have put up. They've not fulfilled their part of the bargain where, you know, they've not been a partner with the state. We put up significantly more dollars than they have to make sure the right things happen with the water quality in our state, and it's very disappointing what they've done.
Governor, a year ago you said that
The House this morning approved a bill that would do away with zero tolerance for the Pop-Tart bill, the water guns, the bubble sprays, and you've been an NRA proponent. If that makes it to your desk, what will you do?
Mike, I haven't seen it.
Last question.
Now, Governor, a year ago or so, you had indicated that you were supportive of the idea of requiring students who receive scholarships, tax credit scholarships, vouchers, to have them take standardized tests identical to the ones that are taken in the public schools. Do you still think that they should take the same standardized tests that kids in public schools take?
Okay, I believe in accountability of anybody that's receiving public dollars.
Thank you.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Kordner, Ronald J. Eben, Lynn Hatter, Stan Jastrzebski, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo, along with Ryan Bank. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPRCapReport. And join us again each weeknight during the 2014 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Tallahassee Regional Airport, offering service through Silver Airways with daily service from Tallahassee to Tampa and Orlando, with connections to the Bahamas. Fares and information available online at silverairways.com. Lisa Miller and Associates, offering strategies to solve legislative, regulatory, and business development challenges. Every challenge offers new opportunities for individually tailored client solutions. Online at lisamillerassociates.com. And from the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, committed to Florida's $71.8 billion hospitality and tourism industry, whose members provide over 1 million Florida jobs. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. More at frla.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.